You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 492. It's kind of fun to do the impossible. Walt Disney.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have filmmaker Fernando Chito Filomarino, and he is the director of the new Netflix film, Beckett, starring John David Washington. And his story on how he got this film made was pretty remarkable, how he's able to come from Italy to make this Netflix film, which wasn't a Netflix film when he got started, but how he got the attention of a major movie star, two major movie stars actually, to come onto this project. And I've had the pleasure of watching it. It is remarkable. It is a fugitive kind of film where the bad guys are chasing a single innocent man across a countryside, and there's 1,000 locations, and the action's great, but the sensibility of the film is very European, and I love that because it was something I haven't really seen a whole lot of before. So it's really, really heavily character based. And Fernando and I, we get into the weeds on how he came up with the story, how he was able to produce it, the production itself, how we got Netflix involved, and so on. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Fernando Chito Filomarino. I'd like to welcome to the show Fernando Chito Filomarino.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I'm glad I did not massacre it too badly, Fernando. But thank you so much for being on the show, my friend. I really appreciate you coming on. We're going to get deep into the weeds on your new film, Beckett, which I absolutely adored, that's coming up on Netflix soon. But before we even get into that, how did you get started in the film business?
The question is specific because it's how I got started in the business, because I guess as a small premise, I always decided, I would say from the age of the beginning of reason, about 11, 12, when you start having ideas, even though they're ridiculous at that age because you're just a little kid, I had decided that I wanted to make movies somehow. So then, you know, I went to high school and everything, and then I went to university. In Italy, we don't really have, we have a couple of film schools, but at university or college, the film programs are film studies. So you watch films and you read books and you analyze them and stuff like that. It's not about the filmmaking process. So I did that. And then after that, I was 21, and I was desperate for film sets because I had been so many years just imagining I want to make this movie and that movie, and I love these movies for these reasons, and okay, let's study film history because I love it, so it's fine. But I was interested in filmmaking, so then all of this, all of these years fueled the absolute obsession with which I looked for a film job first when I graduated from university, looking as for jobs as an AD, basically as an assistant director on anything. I looked in Italy, which was difficult. Also in Italy, I mean Italy has a pretty healthy production, but not, you know, if you compare to America, for sure there are many fewer films produced. But I also looked in the UK because at the time my girlfriend lived there, so I could crash at her place. I had friends. I don't know. I did everything I could, and I landed my first job as an assistant director on a film by Richard Eyre called The Other Man. Mm-hmm. And on that, and I had no experience on film sets at all. So it was funny because the film had kind of an Italian mini section to it, which is, I think, why they hired me. Although, ironically, even though they went to shoot in Milan, which is my hometown, they didn't bring me there because it was too expensive. So I only worked in the UK part of the shoot, although the only reason they hired me was I was Italian.
Right, of
that
course.
Aside, basically, I had no skills except enthusiasm. So they just like, all right, so I don't know, hold this ladder while the gaffer works on that window. And this, my first days were literally like this, just sort of, I don't know what you could do, just do that. Make this coffee. And I was, of course, miles away from the director and the cast. I did Red Light and Bell, which is, in the UK, they do this thing where before shooting, in some productions at least, before shooting, you ring a bell three times and a red light flashes so everyone knows they're shooting and they keep quiet and hold the work. I did that. So that was my first experience in my way into the business. Although, and actually, it was a very important experience because I was so unimportant and had so zero responsibilities, although by the end they did allow me to bring the cast to set and stuff like that. But which was Liam Neeson and Antonio Banderas and Laura Linney, I should say. So pretty cool.
Yeah.
In that position. I got to know what everyone did on set as a guy who doesn't, you know. I just, of course, there were so many people. I knew about the heads of department from my film studies, but not what, like, the prop master. I wasn't sure what a prop master did then. So, you know, that would come in handy, very handy later when I had my first crew on my first short film. But then I got back to Milan, which is my hometown, at exactly the same time Luca Guadagnino was coming to Milan to his movie I Am Love. And he was looking for people to collaborate with him and to help him understand some things of the city, fight certain types of locations, and find people to be in the film that wouldn't be actors, but that would be people from the world he was portraying in the film. And because I was looking for work and he was looking for such a person, we found each other through mutual connections. And I did that film, and that was a completely different experience. And I got to work very closely with him and got to know his working method really closely, and all his collaborators too, which eventually became also my collaborators, some of them anyway. So that was, and that meeting with him and with his producing partner, Marco Morabito, would turn out to be life-changing in some ways, because aside from personal relationships, what happened is I wrote an idea for a short film after that movie was over, and I showed it to Luca, who showed it to Marco, and the two of them said, like, this is great, we want to produce it. Of course, I was so happy. And then it took a year and a half of work to put it together.
You mean to tell me it didn't happen overnight? They didn't just write a check and then you were shooting the next week?
3 weeks later, we were shooting, you know? No, it was a long journey. Also, I was I was a little ambitious in what I wanted to do with the actors. Obviously, it was very conceived to be in one location, a villa, with just a car scene outside of it, so something that would make sense. But my ambition was to work with great actors, and even with writing, I already had an idea of who I wanted to approach for those roles, and they were important actors in Europe and in France and in Italy. But, you know, and that's what all that time, you know, took. But between finding financing and, you know, I still have some debts from that, by the way. I do, really.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure you do.
And coming around to those actors, which eventually, you know, embraced the project and did it, that took a while. And that was my first, you know, I did video stuff beforehand. I was a video maker. I did stuff for the internet, stuff for hire, small, silly things. But that I would consider that short film, which was called Diarchy, my first piece of work as a filmmaker for cinema, let's say. And that, so I guess that's how I got into the business, to answer a very long answer to your question.
Fair enough. Now, when you made your first short film, what was the biggest lesson you learned on that? Because you must have been being bombarded with lessons on a daily basis during that year and a half, and even through production and afterwards. So what was the biggest thing you learned making that first film?
Well, something that I happened to me, I have to say, naturally, was over-preparing. Mm-hmm. And one big lesson I learned is it's never enough. all that hardship that I learned, not during the making, but I guess during the development, is, you know, be ready to be sad all the time and depressed. And feel like it's never going to work out. And people say no. And then they, or even worse, they say yes. And then they change their mind and they say no. And you know, especially looking for funding. But, you know, by the time I got to set, all that time had passed. I had thought about every inch of this short film, how I wanted to shoot it, how I wanted the performances to be and everything. But all that preparation, I realized, you know, I understood, first of all, something that is pretty obvious, which is the amazing luck of working with great performers, because I could have, I envisioned everything, but then the most beautiful thing is when one of the actors, like Louis Garrel, who is a very natural actor who goes by very much by his own instinct and intuition, everything that he came up with that I could not have envisioned was gold. But to go back to what I was saying earlier, there's still so many unexpected things that happen when you're actually shooting something. And just even like this example, also the things that come out of collaborators and actors, there is just no limit to how much you can bring in and then still be surprised. And then also, there's no limit to how much you can prepare and still feel unprepared on the day because of the unexpected. And so, you know, that was, I guess, a hard lesson to learn. But a lesson I learned even later in making my first feature and then eventually my second is the importance of sleep. I actually yes. learned that on my short film. I did not learn that because I basically did not sleep for the whole 6 days of shooting. Ooh. Because I was excited, because I was worrying about everything. And, you know, on day five, I literally walked into my hotel room and I fainted to sleep. But I hadn't slept all of it, because I had more important things to do than sleep. I have to think about tomorrow, to go over the shots I envisioned and you know, prepare. But that was a mistake. And I learned only later the importance of, you know, shutting down and actually falling asleep and letting sleep do its work as well.
Absolutely. No, trust me. I completely understand. And as you get older, you realize about sleep. Because when you're young, you think you could do anything.
Yeah, I was a little young when I did that short film. I couldn't even physically do that now.
yes, me too, my friend. Yeah, now, did you? No. So when you went to on day one with your short film, I do this all the time, and especially when I was first starting out, I really did this. I showed up and I showed my first AD and my DP the shot list for the day. At least for the first half of the day, and I would show up with, like, you know, 175 shots. And then the season first AD and the season DP would go, "That's nice. What do you want to cut?" Did you do that, or do you kind of show up with a bunch of, like, you know, I always like to overshoot, so I always prepare like 30 or 40 shots, well knowing that I'll get 10 of them. If I'm lucky that day, but at least I have that just in case there is where things are moving, things are going quick, and then I kind of get what I want. Is that the way you approach that first short?
Probably out of enthusiasm, I did have more than was feasible, because of course I didn't have the experience to know what would be feasible, right, for sure. However, in general, I have to say my approach is different, and I tend to do the opposite and try to think more about how less shots can do the trick. It depends also on what the film is and what the story requires in terms of pace, for example. That was that short film had to do with something that was burning slow and undercurring and a building tension.
Right.
It wasn't action-packed or anything. It was about the hidden part of a relationship between two friends, let's say, and the tension that was there, and then it sort of bursts for a moment. So, you know, I didn't think I would need fast cutting anything, you know. So in that sense, I have to say, even though I may have overestimated what we could shoot, I don't have that tendency. I didn't have that tendency on that or on my first film, but rather, I guess the difficulty of the shots that I came up with, whether, you know, they were realistically
feasible
to do or not. There was rain and it's all of this is going to be covered in rain, and then we'll have the rain out the window and the, like,
sure.
Yeah, we can't afford that. So there's just one guy spraying water on the window like this.
Right. Yeah. In the director's imagination, you have rainmakers, you've got, you know, rain all over the place, you've got the wide shot, you've got lights for a mile down so you can get these full view shots, and it ends up with a grip with a hose on a window.
That's exactly how it actually, well, like, we couldn't have the hose because it was on the second floor, so it was literally a little spray thing. Like this,
some poor grip side on outside going ch-ch-ch-ch.
yeah exactly. Yeah.
Now, how did you leverage the short film into your first feature film? Because that's a lot of filmmakers are trying to figure out getting their first short film and how they can leverage that to get access to making an actual feature.
I am afraid I did not think that much ahead. I think, look, I had an idea for a short film, which was an idea, a concept, and therefore would work for a short film. And generally, you know, what I love about movies is something to do with creating a world and creating a narrative and then challenging that narrative and challenging the experience of watching the movie. So it kind of is about features. So this idea I had was never really going to work for a feature. It was something that would work for something limited in time. So in that sense, I just kind of conceived that project as it was, and the idea, I mean, I'll tell you, without getting into the story, the concept was also seeing as if it was a piece of a bigger film, but the only very important piece of it, you know? So you see those two people driving in the car, and they've obviously done something before, and then something is obviously going to happen later, but you're seeing the most important piece, and that's it, that fragment of sorts, like a dream, really, where you can't really remember what was before and you can't really remember what happened after, but this is the important bit of the dream. So in that sense, I guess in terms of long lead projects, I did not think ahead that way. I thought, this is cool for a short film. Let's make it the best way we can. And then, I was writing a feature which had absolutely nothing to do with this, which was going to be epic.
Obviously, too epic.
And so when I realized how difficult it was to finance this short film, and then eventually how difficult it would be to finance that feature, which was too epic. Talking with my producers about this conundrum. Then this other idea came along to make what actually became my first feature, which was something smaller, more manageable.
Yeah, and then with the success of that, how did you get involved with Beckett? I mean, because that's a fairly big jump from where you were to an to an action movie with a major up and coming star, if not already a star, as well, and Oscar winner with Alicia in there, and I mean, it's just amazing. So, how did you get involved with Beckett?
Look, first of all, I should specify that, and it depends the perspective. But my first feature was, you know, it had a beautiful festival run, won awards, got some very nice reviews. But, you know, it only got distributed in Italy. It wasn't, right. and on Mubi internationally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was a tiny film. It was a very niche thing. It comes into play. But it's not, I would say, because of, well, I guess you can be the judge of that. I'll tell you how I think it comes into play. Because actually Beckett and the genre of Beckett, which let's say is sort of a dramatic manhunt thriller, mm-hmm. is something I have always wanted to play with. Something I have always loved in movies, ever since I was a little kid, in fact. Mm-hmm. You know, the first filmmaker I ever loved very much was Brian De Palma, which, manhunt aside, the way he deals with genre, and different ones at that, with such a personal point of view, and such warm and dramatic characters, was something that always inspired me from the get-go. And then I guess that inspiration I applied of Manhunt literature, but also movies. And so I always knew I wanted to make a movie in those in that realm, let's say. But obviously it was going to be something more ambitious. And that could not have been something made as a first feature, at least the way I envisioned it. Mm-hmm. The way I wanted, you know, to create a world wide enough to contain something as strong as I would like it to be. But so, you know, what happened is I conceived this story based on what I loved and what I wanted to make more personal and mine, also adding something that would feel fresh today in the genre, because of course we have seen many Manhunt films, but I like the idea of trying to make something new, as I'm sure everyone does. After finding my angle, we approached these actors, and you know, the first thing that happens is they react to what's on the page. John David liked what he read. He liked the idea that this character was completely unusual for this genre, and it was a dramatic character, a man who was going through a personal crisis and who was completely unfit to be, you know, experiencing what happens in the film, and definitely not your typical hero per se, not skilled as a hero of these types of films. And then I guess what my first feature, you know, when he read that, we sent him my first feature, just, you know, oh, and this is the guy who conceived the movie and is going to direct it. And then we had our meeting. And when we had our meeting, the first 15 minutes, John David spoke about my first feature because he loved it. I love this. I love that. I love that performance. And he spoke about that scene at the beginning. And I think that it was an amazing icebreaker, of course, because that movie was so different. You know, it was a portrait of a poet from the 1930s, but yet he could connect to something on there that had to do with the portrayal of character, which of course would come into play in our conversation in Beckett, because actually Beckett is a dramatic character. And so in some ways there was something there, I guess, to argue similarities, at least in approach. Mm-hmm. Then of course the genre would be different. So, you know, I like to think that first feature I did, even though John David would not have seen it unless we'd sent it to him in the context of reading Beckett, it helped our relationship, our dialogue, maybe even his belief in me, you know. So it did come into play in that sense.
And then, so you just basically sent the script out to John David's people. He read it. He liked that. He met with you. At that point, then you started looking for financing, or was Netflix attached? How did that work?
No, Netflix was not attached. We financed the film completely independently with the hard work of my producers. It was in tandem, you know. We were shopping the movie to financiers and simultaneously casting it. And then, of course, when John David decided to make the movie, it started to become a very specific package that we could have. And then eventually we managed to finance it actually with mostly European money, a lot of Italian money, mm-hmm. and a slice of Brazilian money. And then we made the film completely independently. And then Netflix picked it up once we'd finished it as a distributor.
Interesting. So then one thing I've always found, I found issues going through my journeys in Hollywood, especially when I was coming up, is when you do one genre like you did with your first movie, which was much more character-based, and you want to jump genre to essentially a dramatic action film, you know, because there's a lot of stunts, a lot of actions. A lot of times, especially if you're just a director, they say, oh, well, he has no directing. He has no skill. And he has never shot action before. How can we give him millions of dollars to shoot an action? But the big difference with you is that you were also the creator behind it. So you kind of had to, like, if you want the movie, you got to bring me along for the ride. Is that kind of how it worked? And did you come into those walls? Did you hit those walls?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I got asked the question, why, many times. Why, you made the Poet movie, why do you want to do this? I'm like, what's the problem with doing both? I mean, I love poets.
Sure.
I love artists. I thought that movie had a reason to exist because it was interesting to me to see, you know, there aren't that many movies about poets, and I thought it would be interesting to make a movie about poetry and the creative process of a poet. And I also find it interesting to make a Manhunt film with a very dramatic character at its center. Why can't that be?
Right.
And I'm a kind of expert in that genre, even though I'd never shot it before. And I like the idea of, with my perspective, finding my angle through it. You know, and then on the script, I wanted to collaborate it with someone American, especially because of my background and my European perspective. I like the idea because, of course, we were playing with genre tropes that mostly belong to American cinema, mm-hmm. Even though not exclusively, but mostly. I like that our two different perspectives with Kevin Rice, who eventually became the screenwriter on the film, you know, that collaboration, that formula. So I got asked that question a lot. And my answer was always, look, I mean, someone even suggested, oh, and then we'll have a great second unit shoot your action scene.
Right.
And I'm like, no, why? I want to shoot the action scenes.
That's the fun part.
Somebody, I mean, of course, they're pro. We called an amazing stunt coordinator and stunt performers to help us on the movie. That, of course. But why in conceiving the action? No, I want to conceive the action. I want to decide how to shoot it and tailor it on what this character is, the specificity of this character, who, by the way, happens to be not a trained killer, and on this story, on my tone, on my locations, which so informs so much of what the tone of the film is. So, yeah, I got asked that question a lot, and always the argument is, look, I find this story to be interesting both because of this character's perspective, but also, you know, because of the genre. I love the genre. I want to find my way into it. And it was, sometimes it took hard convincing, and sometimes probably it was not convincing.
But you got it done. But you got it in. You got it done.
Yeah. And independently, that's what's interesting, you know. Look, we did go around with the... Of course, the problem, aside from the genre too, is... I had only with one feature.
One dramatic feature,
yeah. So, of course, it was going to be hard. But then, you know, yeah, we got it done. It was a lot of hard work. And of course, having the producers that I had as a team behind me, both because of, you know, their amazing credibility, but also because of sheer work of, you know, finding the right people to talk to and proposing it correctly, setting up our very difficult meetings in which I got asked those weird questions. yeah, so it was It was all of those things.
Sorry for the interruption, guys. We will be right back after a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
For example, another example of that, what you ask is, oh, and then you could get an amazing DP who has a lot of experience in action. And I'm like, again, no. I love to work with my DP who shot my first movie. He's my favorite DP in independent cinema. He's the best. Even though he has not action, he has not shot action.
Oh,
before.
That was a tough pill.
I want me and him to find our action language that is ours.
And you know,
our approach.
And what I love about, and I was telling you this before we started the conversation, was I love the approach to the action in this film. It was so un-American in so many ways, which I'm a connoisseur of cinema, obviously. So when I was watching it, I was just like, oh, this is so fresh. You could obviously tell this is a European director. This is not an American director in the best sense of the word, because just the focus on character, like I felt John David throughout the piece, as opposed to just like some sort of puppet action, you know, 80s character who would just go without any depth. There was so much depth, so much emotion, so much pain in the action and in that character that was so wonderful. And just how you shot the action was raw. And it felt like a constant roller coaster. Like you didn't give up. You didn't give, there was very few moments of break. You were just like, you're just on this thing. And you, like when you held on and you got a hold of the audience, you didn't let go, which I loved. I love that part about the action.
Well, I find that to be, again, I guess depending on the kind of movie you want to make, there is a, where is your focus? And in many movies, I guess, that are more or less thrillers or action thrillers, spectacle is important. And as such, it sucks away, I guess, from other aspects of what can be explored. And in my case, I definitely wanted spectacle and the sense of adventure of this genre to be there. But I wanted to only get there through this character, because I found that, you know, having him be so specific, so unequipped for this experience, going through everything that he's going through, aside from the experience with his own personal crisis, I found that that approach to this arrival at the spectacle would be, I guess, what unique we had to offer. And of course, this is enabled, aside from, you know, conceiving it and planning it, by the amazing performance of John David. So, you know, one thing is you say, all right, so he decides he's running away from danger. He wants to steal that bike. And I guess in a movie which focuses on spectacle, he steals the bike and he speeds through the streets, avoiding all sorts of dangers, and gets away. In this movie, it does not go that way at all. Because, you know, you try to steal a scooter from an angry Greek person who's going to do something very important. I want to see how that goes. You as an average person. And I like the idea even of playing around with this concept of, first of all, challenging the trope. And second, really thinking about how would it go for this character? And not just for the sake of, you know, the spectacle and, again, doing what has been already well covered.
Now,
I guess this angle then informed, of course, how the action took place.
Right, exactly.
And then, therefore, how it shot as a consequence.
Right, exactly. And you can tell that you did not lead with spectacle. Though there is spectacle in the film, no question. But it did not lead with that. And that's so wonderful about it. Now, I was telling this to my wife when we were watching it. I'm like, I think John David's in every single scene, isn't he? There's not one scene he's not. It's pretty much every scene he's in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that must have been brutal for him as an actor. Like, there's not a break.
I joke with him that he actually ran much more than Beckett because he had to do takes.
Exactly. Beckett only had to do it once. And I love about him that you gave him throughout his journey things that would slow him down, injuries and, you know, all these kind of things that I equate with John McClane walking on barefooted on glass in Die Hard.
Yeah.
That you gave him a bunch of that. You didn't have to because it was tough enough, but you added that extra level of stress to the character, which I thought was wonderful. It was just a nice little touch.
Well, I think this actually has to do with as Quentin Tarantino would say it, I guess, delivering the goods of the genre. And I'm quoting something. I remember him talking about Reservoir Dogs, I guess, because the way he was presenting it, I remember, and then I'll stop referencing him, it's a heist film where you don't see the heist. But I still want to deliver the goods and the excitement of that kind of film. Okay, end reference. I get the point to me, you know, the beauty and enjoyment of seeing a great manhunt thriller is it's a kind of road movie.
Yeah.
You know, you have to escape and therefore you cover ground. And therefore ground, landscape, locations, they're very important. And so in that sense, of course, okay, so... He becomes the danger arrives and he decides he wants to go to the U.S. Embassy, which happens to be not where he is at all. Mm-hmm. Now, basically, in a film like this and with this premise, the landscape can change the story because if there is one highway connecting him to the embassy, it's one story. If there's five mountains, four rivers, seven trains, and, you know, a bunch of protesters, it's a different story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes part of the movie. So I would consider it, I guess, more than a touch, actually part of the flesh of the film. And I'll tell you that when I was driving around mainland Greece, where I wanted to set the film, looking for locations, I sometimes even... saw something that was so striking that it was kind of backwards compatibility. Like, okay, so this is great. Let's adapt the scene so that it would work with this location. Because he goes through here, then, you know, this happens as a consequence. And it stays with him for the rest of the film. And in that sense, the land itself became a part of the movie. And I thought that was important for this type of movie, for that sense of adventure and spectacle.
Yeah, of course. Now, do you have any advice for directing actors? Because, I mean, you have some amazing performances in Beckett.
Well, I am a little obsessive. So I like to do a lot of research and collect material for myself, thinking about the characters and how... you know, both in the writing process, but then also thinking about how to make them alive. I like to share that material with the actors I work with. That said, I would say my advice for filmmakers who are starting out is be absolutely open to the instinct and the quality specific to that actor. Because maybe sometimes when younger filmmakers come with so many ideas and so much excitement about, oh, this character has to be like this and like that, may very well be if you're the absolute master of, you know, filmmaking. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, that's not true. And in fact, something like I was saying earlier in our conversation, that the actor might come out with instinct or reacting to the material you share or just from their own baggage. And it's something that you may not have imagined is much richer and more useful at the end of the day to the performance that you seek. So, and that actually works differently from actor to actor. So I guess one has to have, one needs that sensibility of understanding what is the level of dialogue and exchange or even how much you sort of want to give an actor or how much does another type of actor not want to receive very much and want to kind of do their own thing. That is difficult to master, I guess, when you're starting out, finding that sensibility of calibrating how you work with whom. At least that's how I do it. I people are different. Actors have different personalities and different methods, for sure. So I always come with my baggage and my preparation and the material I like to share, and then see what happens and calibrate according to what happens next, you know? And definitely be open to their instinct and everything that they can enrich.
Now, what was the toughest day that you had on set? What was the toughest production day? Like, you're like, oh my God, we're not going to make it. There's always a day like that.
Well, we're not going to make it is not good attitude.
Okay. How can we make it without me dying? No, I'm joking.
Look, I'll tell you the most obvious answer first. And we have, obviously there's two scenes. One that is a rally, a political rally,
where a
politician is going to speak, and then stuff happens, and then later that rally has turned into a riot. Okay, so these are two scenes that are set in the same square. We were lucky enough that basically the municipality of Athens allowed us to shoot in Syntagma Square, the Parliament Square, which is where, you know, when they do rallies, they walk from areas of Athens, they join up, and they arrive in the Parliament Square. That's how it happens in reality. It happens to be humongous. No movie could ever cover it entirely because it's too big. However, they said, you can shoot there. And okay, luxury, amazing, beautiful. But you have only one day. Okay. So, you know, it would be one thing to have one scene to shoot, but we had two, and they were different. So, that was the toughest day on the most obvious terms of what a tough day is. Right. Because, you know, of course we had to plan everything. Of course there were unexpected things, and we just had to deliver so much storytelling and also show so much stuff going on. Plot moments, also that's near the end of the film, so there's a lot going on plot wise but there's also all these people to wrangle. But there's also the problem of, even though we had a lot of extras, there was also 97% of the square was empty.
Wow. It didn't look it.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, to find the angle, but then okay, so that angle works, but then you have to go all the way there to shoot that scene, and then we had to go all the way there to shoot that other moment, and so it was a nightmare, you know, but we hit it.
Yeah, and then there's a big difference in production design from a rally to a riot, as far as just the sets and all that stuff. So, like, once you're like, okay, did we get everything for the rally? Okay, now let's start breaking everything apart. Let's start setting some fires. Let's start, you know, putting some debris down, because you can't go back. After you got one day, you can't go back. Once you've let that go, it's gone.
No, one thing we did manage to which is kind of funny if you know it when you watch the film, but I'll say it anyway, is we did manage to go back to shoot a couple of sidewalks, which means basically that we shot the square scenes, and then there's like a moment that's only on a sidewalk, and that all the characters are looking into the square to this amazing drama that's happening, and actually it was just full of traffic like every day, you know.
That's it. So you went and snuck a cup.
That's the extent that we managed to sort of get some feedback. But you know, the bulk of it we shot on that day, and it was intense. You know, every 20 minutes we had to move and do something else, or the scene would be missing plot points.
Right. Exactly.
We couldn't leave anything behind, and there was no plan, no possible plan B.
Now, what was it like collaborating with John David as a collaborator, as an actor? It's a pretty intense relationship you guys must have had to do a film like this, since he's in every scene. It's action. You're in a foreign land and all this kind of stuff. How was that collaboration?
It was beautiful. And I think the first, you know, referencing again that first meeting that we had about the film, we had a great conversation there, and I think we understood that we were in sync about our taste and the idea of playing with genre. He loves genre cinema as well, very much. And he liked this idea of approaching it from this odd angle with this odd character. So that informed a lot of our first conversation and then eventually our working relationship, because with this exciting understanding that started our dialogue, it was all a nice sort of exploration hunt for ways to best express it. So again, I had a bunch of material that I shared with him, a bunch of movies that I wanted to show him, and then he would react to those, and we'd had beautiful long conversations about why that was interesting, what we can take from that, what we should not take from that. And so that was, I would say that was the most important part of creating that character, or at least, I guess, informing that our working relationship leading to that performance. And then we did so much of that beforehand that by the time we got to set, we had shorthand. You know, we had an understanding, we had a library of references to get to if we needed to, like, remember that moment from that movie that you liked for that and that reason? Yeah, let's think of that. We talked a lot about the relationship that Beckett has with his girlfriend April in the film and the meaning of that relationship. And because the two characters are so different from each other and yet they are completely in love. And that, of course, because of what happens at the beginning of the film, becomes important in the movie inside of Beckett throughout the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. What's going on in his personal crisis. And, you know, it was again, shorthand and easy to go back and reference that. And the thing about John David is that he is obsessive, extremely passionate, and a master minimalist in many ways. So that we had this baggage, we had this dialogue, and then he would just go with his instinct. And that's when I got to sit back and enjoy with everything we talked about. It all sort of went away and disappeared, and then he came out with his talent and his instinct, and then whatever we wanted to change, it was just like, oh, remember that thing we said about the relationship that she wished she could be, but then, you know, that's lost, and he thinks about it now. Just like 10 seconds conversation, it references a whole world that we already discussed beforehand. And we were able to have this complicity, which was, a privileged and gold to me. It also, you know, gave me confidence in the everyday
production. Now, the one thing I want to just kind of put a little spotlight on what you just said is a lot of times first-time directors or young directors don't realize how important collaborating with your lead actors are. And they come in with their ego, their way of doing it, and they're very kind of concrete about, I want my character to do this, this, and this. And they block, and they just kind of disregard what the actor who's playing that character brings to the table. And only through working with actors, you understand that the magic, you're hiring them because they're bringing their magic to them, to this character. So I'm sure that Beckett was created once on the page, but then once John David came in and then both of you started working together, it became what we see. And it wasn't just all your way along. And all the great directors do that because that's the way it should be, right?
Well, that's how it becomes better.
and you could take credit for it as a director. I'm joking. You
yes
know what I mean.
No.
Yeah, of
yes
course, of
no.
course. I'm joking. I'm joking.
The point is exactly, my mind is limited to being one mind.
Right.
I conceived the project. Mm-hmm. I put together the pieces, but, you know, it is only through collaborators who each at their own job is obviously much better than me, come contribute with their ideas. And this is, of course, most important with actors who define very much the final temperature of a movie,
mm-hmm.
the soul of a movie in some ways, and that's kind of why I think when you're reading about film history and stuff, you're like, oh, and then this actor was going to play in that movie, but then, you know, he couldn't, and then this other actor played, and you're like, I can't imagine that. And it's because that, you know, the actor establishes, I think, the beating heart of the movie or the soul of the movie, depending on how spiritual you are, so much that no matter how much you conceived around him and inside him, that talent and that baggage that inevitably an actor is, you know, Bertolucci always said, any feature fiction movie is at the end of the day a documentary about the actors, you know, because they're actors and they act, but at the end of the day they are these humans who go, who are able to go places and deliver what the story needs. And you know, and you can't plan all of that. It's impossible. It's silly. And if you did, it would be probably shallow, you know.
Very.
And it is an actor's qualities, and definitely with John David, I got lucky that make whatever character is at play that real, deep, and you know, in this case, relatable, warm, and strong at the same time.
Now, when is Beckett available for everyone to see?
This Friday, the 13th of August.
Okay, very cool. I tell
it's a lucky
everybody.
Day I hear in America.
It's a
right?
It's a fantastically lucky day. I think you'll do fine. Now, I'm going to ask a few questions I ask all my guests. What advice do you wish you would have gotten at the beginning of your career?
Well, I would say it's a tough question because there's many, I would say.
First one that comes to mind.
The first one that comes to mind, is think absolutely without boundaries, but then also revise with critical editorial mind, you know, to find the essence of what you need to say. You know, when it's so expensive and difficult to make films that, you know, when you're starting out and it's difficult to get any scene made, it's costly and everything, and then you cut stuff and it's on the cutting room floor and you're like, Jesus, you know, if I'd known that I didn't need to shoot that, I would have shot, you know, the other stuff. So it's impossible. I mean, you can't get there, but aspire to that, I guess, to that quality. And then of course, sleep.
sleep. So would that be the advice you would give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today, or would that be some other advice?
Well, I mean, look, it would be a mistake, I think, to give the advice of thinking practically, like, you know, come up with something that you can make that's not too crazy. I think that's wrong. I think one should follow absolutely their instinct and their need to tell stories. Why do you even want to make this in the first place? That reason is what should inform every single decision you make, including how ambitious the project is, how big it is. And then, of course, you just have to be a realist and come with critical mind and understand how you can tailor it, let's say. So, you know, I guess it's a more complicated piece of advice, but that's how I feel I should have, you know, if I'd known that more efficiently, I would have been maybe faster to put things together.
Very good. Now, three of your favorite films of all time.
I like that you say three of my favorite films of all time. So it's not the favorite three necessarily.
No, it's the three that come of currently as we speak today.
Well, I would like to, at least with one or two, reference stuff that inspired me for this film, which remain among my favorite films of all time. And one is 3 Days of the Condor by Sidney Pollack.
Wonderful film.
And another is Manhunt by Fritz Lang. based on an amazing novel by Jeffrey Hushovd called Rogue Mail. And the film and the novel are different, but both are masterpieces for different reasons. And the film is amazing. It's called Manhunt, two words. What can I say? Something more recent. In reference to the amazing composer I got to work with, Ryuichi Sakamoto, I will say, I'm sure to your surprise, Snake Eyes by Brian De Palma.
Yeah, I remember Snake Eyes.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Oh, God, that opening sequence. Just the way that camera... Yeah.
No, I just say it because I know in America it's like, oh, the movie with... that's kind of with the crazy Nicolas Cage, da-da-da-da-da. No, I love that movie, and he is perfect in it. He's the character is crazy.
Listen, Nicolas Cage is a national treasure, and that has to be stated currently. I mean, I don't care what anyone says, Nicolas Cage is a national treasure. Okay. Without question.
We're on the same page.
We're absolutely on the same page. I can watch his early performances, his crazy performances, his subtle performances. He's a national treasure. I enjoyed Snake
Eyes. Snake Eyes, absolutely. Again, speaking about infusing genre with a personal touch, Brian Palma's touch, and with a drama which you do not expect, because you do not expect it when you walk into Snake Eyes. You expect spectacle and on a grand scale, but then you're surprised to be touched and moved, and then more spectacle. It's amazing.
When you can combine spectacle with character and emotion, well, then you have a hit. That's where some of the biggest, some of the biggest blockbusters, Titanic, I mean, for God's sakes, and those kind of films that have that, you're able to do the spectacle, but there's an emotional core that people attach to. That's why when you see these movies that come out of Hollywood, sometimes they're all spectacle. And then the executives are like, why didn't it make money? I'm like, because you got no heart in it. It's not as – just because you can blow up. You can destroy the world 100 times, and we've seen it 100 times, and it's not cool just to see that spectacle anymore. It has to be story. If you don't have story, you don't have character, you don't have something to hold on to, it's just empty. And in today's world, my God, we're bombarded with so much stuff. That when you want that attached, and I think honestly it's one of the things I love about Beckett is the connection, the human connection. I think that's all, what we all thrive for is human connection. And if you can connect to a story on an emotional level, the spectacle is just added cream on top of the cake.
I wish your statement was always true. The example of Snake Eyes makes it not entirely true, because I'm afraid that was not a hit.
There's always reasons for it not to be a hit, but it did connect to you emotionally. And I think De Palma, and we can go for an hour about De Palma, because I'm a huge De Palma fan as well. Sisters, and oh my God, amazing amount of stuff that he's done. And it's so fascinating that he left Hollywood. He's like, screw Hollywood. I'm just going to go to Europe and just make movies now the way I want to make them. And I'm like, thank God.
And Patel was beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the movie he made in Paris.
Amazing. Stunning. It was stunning. It was stunning. But and this is one thing I've said this to people on the show as well, privately. It's unfortunate some of these amazing directors – they might have a flop or something like that, or they have something that doesn't perform well, and then Hollywood takes the keys away from them.
Yeah.
And it's sad, because I want to see another Peter Weir film. I want to see another Wolfgang Petersen film. I want to see these kind of – another Brian De Palma film, maybe with a little bit more money involved so he can do what he does. And yet they take the keys away from him. So I'm so glad that someone like De Palma could just go to Europe and just make the movies he wants to make, how he wants to make them.
I would say that it's interesting, this cross-pollination between Europe and America, just like it's interesting for some European filmmakers to go work in America, depending on the films they want to make. I think it's undervalued how much sometimes it's interesting that American directors go to Europe, not just because they can't make a film in America, but because the context is different and maybe could be stimulating in a different way. And different things go the taste is slightly. I think that cross-pollination is all. You know, I believe in this idea of cinema is all one nation anyway. Mm-hmm. Each of us has their own culture from their own countries, but we all meet in the same land. And I, you know, of course, we referenced a lot of American cinema or British cinema, but I'm also just as much inspired thinking again about Beckett by Hong Kong cinema, you know, and Johnny To movies, or in Japan Takashi Miike movies. Sure. I mean, I love to imagine the ubiquity. Of filmmakers in different landscapes.
And we'll end it on this. There's one filmmaker who got to cross-pollinate over to America back in the 90s. It was Luc Besson. And he did which he did Leon, which is arguably still one of my favorite action films of all time. And and I love his version of it, actually, not the American version that was called The Professional. Like when he added 15 extra minutes that they cut out because it was too risque, it actually made the story even better.
Yeah, I guess that's what I mean with an American director. If he went to Europe, those 15 minutes would be in there, you know?
Right, and then we finally, because Luc Besson became Luc Besson, that the studio's like, well, maybe we should let him have his director's cut, and that came out, and it was Leon, which was originally called Leon, but they never thought it would be. But the reason why that movie works so beautifully is the emotion. I mean, you're crying at the end of an action movie. It's just brilliant, and that is
the way for a character who is most definitely despicable.
He's a killer. But the thing that makes his character so wonderful is that he's basically, you know, just a he's so loving with his plant, and also he kills bad people. He doesn't kill good
and
people.
And more importantly, Gary Oldman is much more despicable than him.
You don't have Gary Oldman, then it's hard to root for Leon. But because you've got Gary Oldman, who is just so God, what a performance that was. God. All right, we can geek out about movies all night. But listen, Fernando, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a pleasure. I wish you continued success. Beckett is a triumph, and I hope everybody watching Netflix gets a chance to watch it this Friday, August the 13th, a very lucky day here in America.
Thank you, Alex.
My friend, thanks again. I'd like to thank Fernando for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you so much, Fernando. And I do suggest you guys watch Beckett on Netflix. It is a hell of a good film. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/492. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.